Monday nights, up late. Broadcasting from stolen land. Satellite skies. Satellite skies. Satellite skies. Highlighting DIY and autonomous politics, music, and subculture with a different theme each week.
You've tuned in to Writing Home on Satellite Skies at 3CR 855 AM. This and every following segment will be recorded on Wurundjeri Wyvern country. We pay our respects to the original owners of this land, the Wurundjeri Wyvern people, as well as their elders, past, present and emerging. Hello everyone, this is Madhvi and Ashwati today in the studio. We'll be reading from Against White Feminism by Rafia Zakaria. This is episode 2 from a 5-part series of feminist readings from the Global South.
Hi everyone, this is Ashwati, Ash, if that's easier to remember. I'm super stoked and excited to be here. Thank you so much for tuning in. Against White Feminism by Rafia Zakaria. Chapter 1. Introduction. At a wine bar, a group of feminists. It is a warm fall evening, and I'm at a Manhattan wine bar with 5 other women. The mood is warm and cheerful. 2 of the women are writers and journalists, like myself, and the other 3 work in the media or the publishing industry. Everyone, except for me, is white. I'm excited to have been included this evening, eager to impress and befriend these women I have previously only known professionally through phone calls and emails. The first huddle comes when the waiter comes to take our order. "Let's split a pitcher of sangria," someone says, and everyone agrees excitedly. Then they turn to me, looking for agreement. "I'm on some medications, but please, you guys go ahead. I'll drink vicariously through you," I declare with a smile whose wattage aims to cover up with discomfort, my own and theirs. It is the truth, but I feel ashamed saying it. They know that I'm Muslim, and I imagine them wondering if I'm too uptight to belong among them. "It's not a religious thing," I add once the waiter is gone. "You have no idea how much I would love a glass right now." There is laughter all around the table. Now I worry that the laughter is forced, and that this audition to belong is already over. The second huddle arrives a little later, when everyone except me has been softened by the sangria and is exchanging personal stories, bonding in the way you're supposed to at a wine bar in Manhattan on a warm fall evening. I see it coming when one of the women, a noted feminist author, looks at me mischievously. "So Rafia, what's your story?" she asks conspiratorially, as if I've been hiding some tantalizing mystery. "Yeah," one of the others, an editor at a literary journal, chimes in. "How did you even come here, like, to America?" It is a question I detest so much that I once used it in a stand-up comedy set. I'm performing now too, but I know a comedic response won't do, will seem like too much of a deflection. But I am prepared for this moment, not least because it has proven tricky to navigate so many times before. Often, as I dramatized in the stand-up routine, I offer up a few white lies. I tell people I came to America when I was 18 to go to college and then stayed. It is only 2/3 of a lie. The truth is, I came to America as a young bride, one night after dinner, sitting on the edge of my bed in mid-90s Karachi. I agreed to an arranged marriage. I was 17. My husband, 13 years older, and a Pakistani-American doctor, had promised to allow me to go to college once we were married. There were other reasons why I said yes, but the possibility of going to college in the United States, something that my conservative family would never have allowed or been able to afford, was a major factor. My life until then had been constrained in all sorts of ways, hardly extending beyond the walls that surrounded our home. I had never experienced freedom, so I gladly signed it away. Arriving in the United States, I moved directly to Nashville, Tennessee. There, I attended a Southern Baptist college when it was still closely affiliated with the church and where exhortations promising fire and brimstone for all non-Baptists were commonplace, which my new husband had selected and enrolled me in, and which I was to pay for via student loans. After graduating college, I begged him for permission to go to law school, to which I had applied, earning a partial scholarship. He refused, then relented, then changed his mind, reminding me that his marital promise had been to let me attend college, not law school. The transactional nature of our relationship stared out at me. The next 7 years did not change things for the better. During our last fight, the police officer who arrived on the scene took his cue from my suddenly calm and courteous husband and told me to patch it up. It was only much later that I learned that this is what police officers tell women who look to them for help all the time. I did not patch it up. I spent the night clutching my sleeping toddler. The next day, after my husband left to do his morning rounds at the hospital, I took her, a small suitcase of clothes, a box of toys and an inflatable mattress, and drove to a domestic violence shelter, an unmarked and unknown house. A woman with blonde hair and bright blue eyeshadow led me there. "Just follow my car," she told me, when we met at a Kmart parking lot, and I did, the Barney theme song playing on a loop inside my car to keep my daughter quiet. I calculate the cost of telling the abbreviated version of my story to the Literary Drinks group. Even if I added a few details, the redacted version would seem curt, close-headed. Telling secrets is the material of friendships. I could begin to weave that fabric now, encompassing them in the warp and weft of my story. But I feel I cannot give them the unedited version. The truth of that ordeal and what I endured afterwards in my struggle to make a life of my own as a young single mother seems glaringly inappropriate for the wine bar and the prettily dressed, slightly soused, fashionably woke companions. I have told the whole truth to such women before, and the reaction has always been the same. There is the widening of eyes, the looks of seriousness and shock, the hands over mouths, the arms slung around my shoulders. When I finish, there is genuine sympathy, a fervent digging around in their own imaginations for some similar story, an aunt, a friend, a personal connection to violence. Then, one of two things happens. If I'm lucky, someone makes a joke or suggests a toast and we move on to another topic, which I eagerly take up. More often, there is an uncomfortable silence as everyone stares at the table or at their drinks. Then a grabbing of purses and phones and a smattering of reasons to leave amid declarations of, "This has been so good and we should do this again and thank you for sharing your story." The words are well meant, but the tone is unmistakable. "I don't remember ever doing this again." I know why. An aversion to acknowledging lived trauma permeates white feminism, which in turn produces a discomfort towards and an alienation from women who have experienced it. I've sensed it every time I have found myself in such a conversation, but have only recently been able to recognize its connection to unexplored assumptions of the value of the voices that have experienced trauma. By and large, there is a division within feminism that is not spoken of, but that has remained seething beneath the surface for years. It is the division between the women who write and speak feminism and the women who live it. The women who have a voice versus the women who have experience. The ones who make the theories and policies and the ones who bear scars and sutures from the fight. While this dichotomy does not always trace racial divides, it is true that by and large, the women who are paid to write about feminism, lead feminist organizations and make feminist policy in the Western world are white and middle class. These are our pundits, our experts, who know or at least claim to know what feminism means and how it works. On the other side are black and brown women, working class women, immigrants, minorities, indigenous women, trans women, and shelter dwellers, many of whom live feminist lives but rarely get to speak or write about them. In the rudimentary sense, there is an assumption that the really strong women, the real feminists, reared by other white feminists, do not end up in abusive situations. In reality, they do, but their disproportionate access to resources such as money, job security, and established social networks means that they end up in shelters or in need of public resources such as Medicaid, food stamps, and subsidized housing far less frequently than women of color in the same position do. Conversely, women of color, who are more often likely to be immigrant and poor, do have to take help from strangers and the state. They are the visibly needy and the obviously victimized. This imbalance is one of the factors that fosters and maintains women of color as a passive source of cautionary tales. White women need help too, and they seek it as well, but the cultural attitudes that paint people of color as freeloaders use any instances of women of color seeking help as a means to confirm that prejudice. There's also the powerful, sometimes voiced, and sometimes implicit assumption that non-white women suffering trauma is the usual state of affairs because their victimhood stems from their unfeminist cultures, while abused white women are portrayed as an aberration, a glitch, and not a reflection of wider trends or values in white culture. This is a prime example of the double standard by which whiteness and the feminism that has sprung from it asserts itself as inherently superior. This phenomenon strongly discourages women like me from owning up to the hardships we have endured, thus further reinforcing the loop of assumption and seeming supporting evidence around what a feminist looks like. Educated, successful feminist women do not come from backgrounds of abuse, exploitation, or trauma, and therefore, women who have experienced these things are not credible feminists. The threat of being perceived as substantiating a discriminatory cultural norm, that of the abused woman of color, and in my case, the immigrant and abused woman of color, enforces its own silence. I know that identifying myself as someone who has done time in the trenches, lived in fear for my life, moved from shelter to shelter, and who carries the scars of that trauma will win me momentary praise from white women. And in that instant, they will say the right things, marvel at my courage, ask questions about what hiding from an abuser was like, what being a single mother entails. But my ownership of this othered identity will also allow them to demote me as being below the women who do the real work of feminism, define its boundaries, its intellectual parameters and policies. Real feminists, in their eyes, are fighting for the cause in the public arena, untrammeled by the shifting burden of messy experience. What I feel in these moments is not imposter syndrome. At the wine bar in Manhattan, I know that I have experienced more and overcome more than the women with me tonight. But I also know that my companion's world is split into women of color who have stories to tell or to be told on their behalf about their own specific experiences, and white women who have the perspective and authority to wield power responsibly on behalf of everyone. There is a racial hierarchy here that is left unacknowledged and hence intact. Some women are there to show us all why we need feminism, and others are there to make it happen, try to get it to work. This dichotomous view of how feminism works, or indeed how any movement for social change should work, is a central mechanism which slots women of color's experiences under the mental label of other, allowing them to be automatically dismissed in the arena of white feminism. Another factor at play in this ranking of feminists is the myth of relatability. The language of personal preference used to legitimize the narrowness of white empathy, the rigidity of the white imagination. The academic departments, publishing houses, newsrooms, international NGO boards, and civil rights agencies of the Western world are filled with white middle-class women. In order to be welcomed into these spaces of power, I need to be relatable to those who fill them to fit into the spaces of power. I must be recognizable in my humanity, specifically to white and middle-class people, must accommodate their assumptions about what a good person looks and sounds like, however biased, unreasonable, or self-involved those assumptions are, or pay the price with my own exclusion. On a superficial level, I can demonstrate kinship with middle-class white women via mentions of fervent feminist awakenings in college, dating mishaps or various apps, curated details of an affluent urban life, and a diligent skincare routine. I can also demonstrate it by not mentioning the kinds of experiences white people believe do not apply to them. Certain kinds of domestic abuse, certain kinds of migration, certain kinds of internecine conflict. The cult of relatability rationalizes the exclusion of certain kinds of lived experience from the hierarchies of feminist power with pervasive consequences for feminist thought and praxis. Many institutions involved in feminist policy making do not just refuse to consider the lived experience of women of color as a useful perspective for colleagues to bring to the table, they actually treat it as a strike against applicants, claiming they will be less objective because of it.
You're listening to 3CR
Community Radio,
855 AM.
Literary theorist Gayatri Chakravarti Spivak first pointed out how Europeans assume that they know the other, placing it in the context of the oppressed. In her groundbreaking essay, Can the Subaltern Speak?, her famous articulation of white men saving brown women from brown men is a theoretical framework that undergirds much of this book. Spivak identifies the ways in which colonial populations, the subaltern of her essay's title, were historically logged out of power by their imperial oppressors, unable in any sense to speak. I am interested in examining how women of color today are given some chances to speak, but are still not heard. Unlike Spivak's work, this is not a book about feminist theory, but rather feminist practice and its problematic genealogies, the injustices of the past which persist and re-emerge in new forms in the present. In the gender-only narrative that has long dominated mainstream feminism, all women are pitted against all men, with whom they seek parity. In this struggle, white women have taken for themselves the right to speak for all women, occasionally allowing a woman of color to speak, but only when she can do so in the tone and language of white women, adopting the priorities, causes, and arguments of whiteness. But the assumption that women together stand with the same disadvantages against men is flawed. All white women enjoy white racial privilege, whereas women of color are affected not simply by gender inequality, but also by racial inequality. A color-blind feminism thus imposes a cost on women of color, erasing a central part of their lived experience and their political reality. This makes it impossible, more generally, to see the ways in which a white-centric feminism is not serving their needs. Growing up in Pakistan, I saw my mother, my grandmother, and my aunt survive terrible suffering of all sorts. They experienced migrations, devastating business losses, inept husbands, lost relations, legal discrimination, and so much more. Without ever giving into despair, without ever abandoning those who relied on them, without ever failing to show up, their resilience, their sense of responsibility, their empathy, and their capacity for hope are also feminist qualities, but not ones that the current feminist arithmetic will permit. In the value system of white feminism, it is rebellion, rather than resilience, that is seen as the ultimate feminist virtue. My maternal forebears' endurance is labeled a pre-feminist impulse, misguided, unenlightened, and unable to deliver change. No attention can be garnered by Pakistani feminists unless they do something that is recognizable within the white feminist sphere of experience. Skateboard while wearing their headscarves, march with placards, write a book about sex, run away to the West. The truth that resilience may be just as much as a feminist quality as rebellion is lost in the story of feminism that is written and populated entirely by white women. This too is a legacy of white supremacy. Feminism itself has never been disaggregated from the white gaze. It has become the only kind of feminism we recognize or even have language for. And that means that most of the time when women speak feminism, they unintentionally take on the cadence and concerns of whiteness. It is not enough for alternative narratives of women of color simply to exist. They must actually influence the content and the course of the movement of gender parity. A white woman takes on the task of speaking for raped and brutalized other women, positioning herself as the rescuer and the conduit through which emancipation must flow. If European feminists are terribly annoyed at Muslim women who insist on covering up their bodies today, they were equally annoyed by the lack of coverings worn by Hindu women then. Annette Aykroyd was a British woman who set off for Bengal to build a school. Once there, she remarked that she found the sari as a garment both vulgar and inappropriate, as it left women, in her view, semi-nude. "There must be a decided change in the lower garments," she complained in a letter home after her arrival. "They cannot go into public places in such costumes." Even when she encountered a well-to-do Bengali woman, she likened the way that the woman dressed and sat to a savage who had never heard of dignity or modesty. Constructing a true feminist solidarity involves exposing and excavating the supremacy of whiteness from within feminism today.
If women of color have roles in white feminism today, their cameos, the supporting cast or the targets of pity, grasping for survival or for a school or a health clinic, rather than whole and complex humans. We are expected to be tellers of sad stories where we detail how our particularly brutal men, our inherently flawed culture, our singularly draconian religion, but never the actions or inaction of white people, have caused us indescribable pain. For their part, white feminists offer us their precious and perhaps their righteous indignation at the savagery of our native cultures, which have left us in such a hopeless mess, pitiably but patiently waiting for their interventions, by force or by money, to sort things out.
நீயே காற்றும் நீயே தோடும் நீ
Welcome back to Writing Home. This is Ashwati and Madhavi, and we are reading Against White Feminism by Rafia Zakaria. The White Savior Industrial Complex and the Ungrateful Brown Feminist. For a long time, development professionals, NGOs, and the United Nations have been trying to eradicate wood-burning stubs in rural India. In the 1990s, after the Beijing Declaration set out the vague agenda of equality, development, and peace for all women, the eradication of wood-burning stubs became the focus of feminists, modernization advocates, environmental activists, and a slew of other reformers. Together, they set about tackling the task of liberating rural Indian women to participate in a wage-earning economy by giving them a better stub than the one that, according to excavations in the area, had been in use since 1800 BC. The project would deliver empowerment and cleaner air and would end the depletion of forests. In 2010, the United Nations Global Alliance for Clean Stubs promised to distribute 100 million clean stubs by 2020. The World Bank amassed a 130 million portfolio from 13 donor countries for the provision of clean stubs. But no one asked the women who did the cooking, whether they wanted the new stubs or considered the reasons why. As it turned out, they did not want them. For one, collecting fuel wood, which does not involve the cutting down of whole trees or have the environmental impact it was alleged to have, had been for centuries a ritual in which rural women established and maintained their social bonds. It was in these exchanges that they discussed how to solve problems in their lives and how to overcome the many hardships faced by the communities, and shared their joys and losses as well as news of relatives and friends. It was an essential part of the women-only socialization in these areas. In addition, the new stubs were incompatible with the preparation of certain recipes which required a traditional stub and had been part of the local culture for centuries. Furthermore, when the clean stubs broke down, they could not be repaired easily in the village, while the old stubs could. Perhaps even more importantly, many of these rural Indian women rejected the idea that the route to empowerment was making themselves available for wage-earning work rather than the literal tending of their own hearths, the cooking and caring for the household from the central point, which they saw as an exercise of power. Adhering to traditional recipes and cooking methods that required the old stubs was a reflection of their own commitment to the heritage they saw as sustaining their own and their family's lives. According to researchers, the commercial forestry industry, the clearing of land for agricultural use, and urbanization each have a much more significant impact on deforestation than the collection of fuel wood. The traditional stubs do pollute, they do create smoky interiors, they do require a lot of labor on the part of the women who use them, who can experience breathing issues because of them, and who surely have ideas about improving them. A solution is needed, but it cannot be a solution that only makes sense to the affluent, white, Western program managers. It has to be a solution that works for rural Indian women.
Yeah. voice of the future speak to me kindly. Ask for what I want, and somehow it find me. Somehow it find me. Somehow it find me.
Hello everyone, welcome back to Writing Home. This is Madhvi and Ashwati. We've been reading from Against White Feminism by Rafia Zakaria.
Do you work in a brothel, massage shop, escort agency, fetish house or dungeon, cam studio or porn set, sauna, short-time hotel, outdoors or on the street, or in any other space where sex work happens? Recent changes to Victorian sex work laws mean that sex workers now have more options for how and where we can work and who we can work with.
To find out more about Victoria's new sex work laws, contact Vixen, Victoria's statewide peer-only sex work organisation, 100% by and for all sex workers on 039-070-9050.
And talk to another sex worker about what the partial decriminalisation of sex work means for you, your workplace and your community. Or check out the Decrim Info Hub at vixen.org.au. Vixen is a 3CR supporter.
In Zero Dark Thirty, and the true story behind it, American feminism, once a movement that existed in opposition to the state as a critique of its institutions and mores, is recast as an aid that serves the state's interests by any means imaginable. This identification with those interests, as well as the desire to go out and conquer the world with the same mindset of oppression and domination modeled by white men, seems to have become a warped feminist goal. Put another way, white women have wanted parity with white men at any cost, including by avidly taking on the domination of people of color. As white feminists have progressed within their societies and begun to occupy increasingly important positions, they are constructing a feminism that uses the lives of non-white people as arenas in which they can prove their credentials to white men.
Sexual liberation is women's empowerment. Against White Feminism by Rafia Zakaria. When I was taking that grad class in feminist theory, few feminists were questioning compulsory sexuality or the push to understand everything about gender identity and gender relations through the rubric of sexuality. I first wrote about it for the New Republic in 2015, and even then it was still a relatively new idea. When that article went online, I received many letters from women. most of them brown, who ardently agreed and told me how they had been waiting for such an argument. Undoubtedly, the message was not a new one in more conservative countries like Pakistan, where the sexualization of Western societies is routinely critiqued and held up as a symbol of moral decay. But what I was saying was different. It did not come from a place of faith, but rather from one which saw the limits of the transformational power of sexy feminism in a society where sex had been thoroughly co-opted by capitalism, and it identified the white feminist tendency to discard any critique of compulsory sexuality coming from a brown Muslim woman as an expression of some latent discomfort with sex itself. I was criticizing the loss of feminism's power to take on capitalism. A month before the New Republic article went to print, The Nation columnist Michelle Goldberg noted that for a lot of people, the contemporary sexual regime, celebrating pleasure above all else, isn't that much fun. Goldberg was discussing the work of Rachel Hills, an Australian feminist who spent several years documenting the consequences of sexual liberation for millennials, having sex, even a lot of sex. Hills argued had become its own oppressive sexual convention. Hills thinks that true female sexual autonomy doesn't just necessitate the right for women to have sex without stigma or judgment. Although this is of course important, it also entails the right to confidently not have sex when it is unwanted or unavailable on the terms she might prefer. She also presents findings from hundreds of interviews she has conducted, many of them stories from women who felt that they had to pretend to be more sexual than they were in order to fit into the ideal of the cool, hip feminist. Magazines like Cosmopolitan and others marketed to women bolster this paradigm, pushing the achievement of orgasms, adventurous sex lives, and the constant incorporation of novelty as the basis for a good and even healthy sexual life. All of this, Hills concludes, has led to the transformation of women from sexual objects to sexual subjects. While the former were policed by other people, the latter policed themselves, watching and regulating their own behavior in order to create for themselves an identity that fits the cultural ideal. The co-opting of Western feminism by capitalism through the Trojan horse of sexual liberation can be witnessed anew as it turns its attention to queer culture. Concepts like sexual society and compulsory sexuality are useful here not simply to point out the universal expectation for feminists to have sex and the tyranny of that pressure for asexual women, who are implicitly closed out of feminist acceptance. They also show how late capitalism continues its work in the name of sexual liberation, to commodify new sexual orientations. Once a sexual orientation is essentialized and defined, it is then reborn as a market category of people to whom particular things can be sold. Freedom, even sexual freedom, is thus reduced to the freedom to consume and perform, rather than meaning justice or equality or the redistribution of resources. For political movements centered on these issues, the realm of possibility is submerged and subsumed by the commodifying capacities of capitalist enterprise. Recognition of LGBTQIA+ identities has come to mean not just equal rights within legal systems, but also voracious marketing to those who belong to them. Equality means corporate recognition of a consumer category and the development of a consumerism which offers products to particular sexual identities, passing this off as a form of empowerment. Further, Rafia Zakaria quotes various examples, which I love this book so much. Against White Feminism by Rafia Zakaria. I feel like everyone should be reading this book. And it's bizarre that once I was at some bookstore and I just saw Against White Feminism. I never heard about Against White Feminism from my peers or my friends who are very feminist, like they are extreme feminist, okay? I never heard about this book. Most of the books those books were also served a purpose, but I think this book just pretty much nailed everything for me. So random. Just saw the book and I was like, oh, nice cover. I like the colors. And Against White Feminism, of course, you know. I mean, back then, I think my motivation to that particular day to bookshop might have been to look for something that talks about race, you know. Oh, I remember now. I remember I bought this book. I think I came back from India and I had not been reading. And something, I don't want to share my drama story, but something racial happened. And it was pretty, it was a lot. I bought this book and I remember showing it to my friend and the first 10 pages and I was just like, oh my God, I know I had the answers now and blah, blah, blah. And I mean, I couldn't go past the 10 because I had to heal in other ways. But that day, I think my motivation might have been slightly different and somehow I picked this book. It was meant to be. And 2 years later, I'm revisiting it and also trying to finish it. That's the kind of reader I am. But thank you all for joining us today. I will absolutely recommend Against White Feminism by Rafia Zakaria. This book will definitely change your life, not just in the sense of understanding the world or being a better ally, but also it will liberate you. I think that's what we are here for. We want everyone to be free. And I want all of you to be free from all that Rafia says. So, thank you. And Ashwati's here. Ashwati is also saying goodbye to you all. We might see you next time in our next segment. Till then, take care. Bye-bye.
பார்த்து அடிக்க மங்கள டம் டம் ஓல டம் டம் முதுக்கு டம் டம் ஓங்கி தட்டிக்கும் ஒட்டிக டம் டம் மால டம் டம் மஞ்சள டம் டம் பார்த்து அடிக்க மங்கள டம் டம் ஓல டம் டம் முதுக்கு டம் டம் ஓங்கி தட்டிக்கும் ஒட்டிக டம் டம்
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to www.3cr.org.au.